We saw some exciting things, some interesting things, some scary things happen during that time. What are some of the changes in the law that have had the biggest impact on you as a judge over the last 10 months since September 1st? Any big change for you? Well, one big change for the whole state is that now municipal judges have the right to perform marriages, which we'll hear more about tomorrow from Odell Holmes. So that was a big change for some, something that the Municipal Courts Association had been working on for years and years and years. We saw some changes for blood draw warrants. One thing that may have caused some headaches for you is the non-disclosure orders for juveniles, which we'll have a class on tomorrow. But what we're going to focus on over these next 50 minutes are the changes, procedural changes, so mainly changes to the Code of Criminal Procedure that affected us. Does anybody feel like you just got used to the changes of the last legislative session and now it's time to incorporate the 81st? Anybody? Anybody come from the school where just when you figure out how to program the clock on your VCR, it's time to go get a DVD player? Sometimes we fall into those routines of being settled in what has been status quo for a long time, and then we're forced to deal with these new changes. I think Jerry Seinfeld said, those that work in the law are the ones in the board game of life, they're the ones that have to be in charge of reading all the directions. So that's true. But when we're playing this board game of life, unfortunately, the directions keep being rewritten, and we have to keep an eye on what those changes are. Here's a quote from Benjamin Franklin. No one's life, liberty, or property are safe, while the legislature is in session. Benjamin Franklin. Anybody agree with that quote? Anybody get a little scared when the legislative session starts? That's true. I think a lot of us do get a little bit worried. But on the flip side, what's the alternative? Without any legislature, without any laws, we'd obviously have maybe some more problems. Let's talk briefly about the legislative process. Everybody close their eyes for a second. And I want you to envision yourself back in your junior high classroom, in your civics class, or your government class, or your Texas history, or anything like that. And I know it's probably a scary time for a lot of us back there in junior high, but that's for the next 30 seconds on this slide. We're going to take you back to a little lesson about the Texas legislature here. It meets every 2 years. It lasts 140 days, and all the bills must pass both chambers, that's the House and the Senate, and be approved by the governor. You learned all this, I'm sure, in that cartoon this morning. I'm just a bill. Here's some numbers for you, though. During this legislative session, there were 7,609 bills and proposed constitutional amendments filed. That's a 19% increase from the 80th legislative session and a 29% increase from the 76th legislative session back in 1999. If we see similar growth of 19% again before the next legislative session, we're going to be looking at over 9,000 proposed bills and constitutional amendments next summer. So we'll see if that holds true. The flip side to that is, even though there are more filed, there are less getting through, percentage-wise. So there's more targets for people to shoot at as well. According to the Texas Municipal League, they said it's likely that no other American legislative body has ever filed that many bills in a biennium, and the volume of bills was made even harder to handle by a 5-day late-session talkathon that prevented a voter identification bill from being considered for passage but held up dozens of other measures. If you follow the legislative, what's going on in the legislature, it gets pretty crazy. They're supposed to stop at midnight, so instead of stopping at midnight, they unplug the clock so that the clock never hits midnight so they can freeze time and just keep talking for more time and longer hours. Some of the tricks that the legislators pull are pretty amusing. They do have the power to freeze time. But the number of bills passed did decline. 2007, we saw 23.5%. This last one was down to 19.3%. So that is a change. If you look in the book, what I've put in the book for you, before the slides is kind of an outline form where you can feel free to take notes on each bill. And I've structured it when we did all our legislative updates. We talked about each thing by the bill number, and we went through numerical order and by subject of the bills. Today we're going to go through by the order of the Code of Criminal Procedure. So if you look at the purpose of the Code of Criminal Procedure in the statute, it says it's intended to embrace rules applicable to the prevention and prosecution of offenses, to make the rules intelligible to the officers who are to act under them, and it's also laid out in sequence. It should follow chronologically the timeline of a criminal action. So if you were to just browse through the Code of Criminal Procedure, you'd notice that chapters 2, 3, and 4 would talk about duties and then defenses and jurisdiction. A little further, 14 and 15, arrests, magistration. Then 27, pleadings. 30s talks about trial. In the 40s, we get into judgment. So it should follow that chronological timeline. And then we have our special section, chapter 45, that pertains just to municipal courts and justice courts, that really gives us a lot of guidance. So we're going to follow that format as we walk through these today, and I'll try to go through as quickly as possible because I know it will be getting warm for all of us in here. Starting in chapter 2, if you look to chapter 2 in the Code of Criminal Procedure, the name of the chapter is General Duties of Officers. And here we're specifically talking about Article 2.12. And basically what happened here is in House Bill 3201, county fire marshals were added as in the long laundry list of designated peace officers. Okay, so that list has been there, and it just has continued to grow, and it added one more person. Does anybody know how many different categories of peace officers there are now in the Code of Criminal Procedure? Anybody want to guess? 14, I hear. Anybody? Do I hear 15? Do I hear 20? 25? 30? 35? Nobody? This makes number 36. There's 36 different peace officers. Why do you care as a municipal judge who's a peace officer and who isn't? Down there at the bottom, it's one more person who can write a citation, one more person that can start the ball rolling of a criminal action in your court. It's probably the most common way for a case to get started. So that's chapter 2. We're going to jump ahead to chapter 4, which deals with courts and criminal jurisdiction. Is anybody here from Houston? Okay, we got a couple people from Houston. Anybody from a town neighboring Houston? This law specifically only applies to Houston and its surrounding areas right now, but it might be a glimpse of what's to come. Article 4.14, dealing with the jurisdiction of municipal courts, was changed with Senate Bill 1504. It allows concurrent jurisdiction in Houston Municipal Court and a contiguous municipal court in a neighboring community. And it also made a conforming change, Article 13.045, boundaries of certain municipalities, which you might see a space for that in your outline when we get to Chapter 13. We won't spend a lot of time on it. This is how it works. Houston and the neighboring community can enter into an agreement that they have concurrent jurisdiction for offenses that happen on the boundary line or within 200 yards of that boundary. So if there's an offense that's committed very near to that boundary line, but it's on the Houston side, a community that wants to enforce that offense can do that if it's within 200 yards. The reason this came about, according to one of our municipal judges in a small community next to Houston, is that it's a small community. They have a lot of control over the community, gated community, and one of their schools was right on the borderline with Houston. Well, there were some things happening right on the Houston side, just across that border, they were concerned about. So they went and lobbied and got this change so that now they can enforce even beyond their city limits there with that concurrent jurisdiction agreement. So the way that the legislature limited it to just Houston is that it only applies to municipalities of 1.9 million or more. And Houston proper is the only city that has that many people within its city limits. There might be some other cities getting close, but right now it's the only one that has the benefit or the burden from your perspective of this possibility here. Okay. Chapter 12. Moving on, chapter 12 deals with limitation. And this is a big change. Article 12.02, misdemeanors. This talks about the statute of limitations in Class C misdemeanors. It's a big change in the language of the law. Practically, probably all of you have been following this statute of limitations for a long time. But effective September 1st, 2009, a complaint for any Class C misdemeanor may be presented within 2 years from the date of the offense and not afterward. So basically, that's just telling us very clearly that we do have a 2-year statute of limitation. Most people assumed that we always did, but the statute never said complaint. It only referred to, what did it refer to? Anybody know? Indictments and information were the only two that they referred to, so complaints was not talked about. Everybody assumed they meant to include all charging instruments, but it wasn't there. Now it is, so there is a 2-year statute of limitations. There's always been a minority perspective that you don't need, that there's not a 2-year statute of limitations, because once a citation is issued, it tolls it because it's a limited substitute. And that's true in certain instances, but in what case can you use a citation in place of a formal complaint? And we accept citations all the time, but in what instances do you never have to get to the formal complaint part? Somebody pleads to the ticket, right? If they say, I'm guilty, and they go ahead and take it, then there's no reason to go through the formality of a formal complaint and to get that. So they're waiving. They don't need a formal complaint if they're going to plead out to the ticket. Or it is possible, if they decide to plead not guilty, for them to waive their right to a formal complaint and proceed to trial on the citation. That probably very rarely happens. Usually defendants don't want to make it any easier on the other side. And if they were to try and do that, it would probably be strategic, because they would feel that there was some defect in the citation. It doesn't happen a whole lot. But now it's very clear we have a 2-year statute of limitations. No complaint can be filed after that. Has anybody come into office within the last 2 years as a municipal judge? Okay. When you came into office, did you inherit a headache, as far as we hear stories of people inheriting their judgeship, you know, being appointed in their shoeboxes of things from 5 years ago, 10 years ago, that were never properly disposed? Anybody run into those types of situations? There's never been a formal complaint filed. So what do you do now? Now you step into a new position as a judge. You've got a shoebox of things from 5, 6, 7 years ago that are still out there as charges, but a formal complaint was never filed. And then you get a check in the mail from Joe Offender, and Joe Offender has sent you $200 to satisfy this thing from 3 years ago or 4 years ago or 10 years ago that's beyond the statute of limitations, but there was never a complaint filed. Is there a problem with taking that money at that point? Pardon? Okay, one judge says the case doesn't exist. Now, I will say, in talking to all the judges in 10 schools, you're probably thinking in your head, I've met very, very few courts that send money back. You know, if they get fine money in, they'll take it and they'll figure it out. Here's the argument. So, oh yeah, taking it is different than should they. Here's the argument. The argument is that the statute of limitations is a defense that has to be raised by the defendant. So as you said, Judge, they're waiving it. If they're sending it in, the argument is they are obviously waiving their right to a formal complaint if they're pleading guilty to something. And so that's the perspective that some people have, that because it's a defense that has to be brought up by the defendant, if they're paying, there's not a problem with accepting that. But that might be something to keep an eye on to see if any case law is more illustrative. Yes?
Taking that one step further, wouldn't you just routine all of that out and dismiss it? Once it's dismissed, then you have the same problem?
I think once it's dismissed, you would have to send it back, because there's nothing there at all. There's nothing for them to waive. I mean, there's no charge, you know, citation or otherwise. And we hear about that. Sometimes courts go through this purging process that say, we want to get rid of all these things from 10 years ago, so they're either dismissed or some sort of administrative purge. And there's no guideline in the statute for how that should be done or if it can be done, but it is done so that courts can report and say, we're collecting not just 20% this year, it's 25% or whatever. But that's pretty common. But I think if it has been dismissed, there shouldn't be anything in the system anymore. Well, but it has been presented for... Well, and these problems are going to go away, and we'll see this has a companion bill that we're going to get to. But basically, the problem that some people run into is that there were just citations, never complaints, and now they're beyond the statute of limitations, but people are still trying to collect, they're trying to enforce, and that could be problematic. But I think there is a status, even if it's just a citation, whereas if it has been dismissed, there's no more status at all. Yes, Judge? Well, I would say generally you're correct. The citation and complaint are two different things. It is possible that somebody has drafted a citation that satisfies all the requirements of a complaint and it's been sworn to and all that, but I would say it's very rare, very rare. The question is, if you have a citation that doubles as a complaint because it is a complaint, it is not a mere citation, and they come in later, once there's a complaint filed, it's good forever. So it's good. It's very rare for it to be so. So you would have to make sure with your city attorney that it, and I would say it's very, very rare, like probably less than one, you know, a fraction of 1% that you have a citation that does satisfy all of the requirements of complaint. It's possible. I've heard of people trying to do it. I just think there's probably going to be some misstep or something missing that kicks it back into a citation status. What'd you say? A citation worded as a complaint. That could be the case. That could be the case. I would say I would not count that your citation counts as a complaint. Cities have made efforts to try and include all of that. I think it's very rare, and I don't know of anybody that clearly successfully has done it. So I would, if it's just a citation, I would consider it a citation. And if it's a complaint is filed. Pardon? Okay. Well, then if it's beyond 2 years, then it's beyond the statute of limitations. I would talk to your city attorney. I would bet that your citation probably does not satisfy all of the complaint requirements. So if they came in after 2 years, it would be beyond the statute of limitations. You couldn't proceed to trial on a complaint at that point. You couldn't go to trial on that unless they waived that right and didn't bring up the statute of limitations. So I would consider them as wholly two separate things, and there have been attempts to try and satisfy both with one thing, but very rarely has that been successful. Yes? It's from the date of the offense. So if they were issued a speeding citation today, but it didn't get filed with the court until 3 days from now, the date that starts that two days is the offense, when they received the citation. Correct, from the offense, from the commission of the offense. So within those 2 years, a complaint would have to be filed and not thereafter. And we'll see there's another bill we'll get to that should clear up these issues. This shouldn't be a problem going forward. Okay, question, what are these people trying to do? Read everything on the ticket, good guess. If you can read that, it says they're trying to read this fine print on your new citations. I know that Mr. Setliff talked about this, so we'll just go through very quickly. This is the admonishment stuff, domestic violence admonishment regarding handguns for Class C assault. It amended 1406 and 27.14, also in Chapter 26, to authorize that federally mandated admonishment language be put on the Class C citations. So it's taken out of one section of the law where you had to give this orally in open court, and now it's being put on the citations. If they didn't get a citation and you're seeing them you're still going to have to give that orally, so it's probably a good idea to do it both ways. But now it has to be on the citation. Yes? Any answers to that? What do you do with a firearm that you own and you can't transfer it? I don't think you have to advise him, but I don't know. I don't know the best answer to that. Advise him to an attorney, maybe the licensing authority that gave him the license. But you're saying it bars transfer, so they're in a bad position if they've been admonished. And this, again, is just an admonishment, so nothing necessarily is happening yet. So that's a good question. Here's another tricky issue that just came up with concealed handgun license in the Dallas area. I got a call. Apparently now it's becoming a big business for concealed handgun classes offered in the Dallas area to receive a Utah concealed handgun license. It's got shorter classroom requirements, less testing, and all of this, but somehow they're able to offer these classes in the state of Texas, give them a handgun license for Utah. Texas has a reciprocal agreement with Utah, so what happens if in your EPO you restrict, you know, the mandated restrictions on handgun use? How do you're supposed to notify the licensing authority in Texas that this is going on, but what do you do now if they're licensed in Utah? So keep your eyes open to see what happens with that, because that could be an issue with states coming into our state to offer licenses from out of state. And I don't think there's a clear answer yet. Okay, 1508 and 1509, transmittal of complaints and warrants. Show of hands, did anybody come to this regional judges program on horseback or covered wagon or anything like that? No. Okay, this does the same thing. Transmittal of complaints and warrants, this is one of these bills that just brings us into the 21st century. It updates it. In the past, the only legal way under the statute to transmit a complaint and a warrant was telegraph. Does anybody use a telegraph? Just this gentleman here. Right. Well, but I'm telling you, that's why they had to change the statute. That's the only way that you could transmit them in the past. So now they've taken out that language of using a telegraph, and they replaced it with some more generic language. It says a warrant may be forwarded by any means or any method that ensures the transmission of a duplicate. So that it really opens it wide to use email, fax, things like that. So, brought us into the 21st century, maybe even the 20th century. Okay. Duties of the magistrate. Senate Bill 415. This is another conforming change because it just didn't make sense in the past. In the past, it says that the magistrate could release somebody without bail for a Class C misdemeanor and order them to appear in the county court for arraignment. That's what the statute said in the past. Well, does it make any sense to tell somebody accused of a Class C to go get arraigned in county court? No. We know that the jurisdiction for a Class C misdemeanor is going to be in municipal or justice court, so they made the change here. Now it says a magistrate can release without bail for Class C misdemeanors and order their appearance in the applicable justice or municipal court. They just cleaned it up, made it make a little bit more sense in case anybody was sending them to the county court and the county court saying, get out of here, I'm not going to arraign you for a Class C. Okay. I will tell you that in the first edition of the latest code book that LexisNexis printed with our seal on it, it didn't have that change, so it still said county court. And we'll let them know, and hopefully they'll get that change made. 1916, there were the absent juror fine. We're talking about contempt here. There were several changes to contempt laws. Basically, most of them shifted the fine amounts. So this changed the fine amount from a minimum of 10 and a maximum of $100 to a minimum of 100 to a maximum of 500. Now, this is Article 1916 contempt. Just want to bring it to your attention that for some reason, the legislature did not amend 45.027, municipal court contempt, all right? But you do have the power to hold people in contempt under different statutes. So it's still capped at $100, but if you hold them in contempt under the government code, it did up the fine amount there. Why is that?
Because the new range is 100 to 500, the old range is up to 100. So if you put them together, you can only find them 100.
You don't have to put it together. The old range is gone now. The new range is now 100 to 500. So it was in effect.
45 is capped at
$100. It is, yeah. Under 40. Right, but those are two. 45027 is a different contempt statute than 1916. So I'm just making sure. Most all contempt statutes changed and upped the range. Our specific one in Chapter 45 did not. So it still has that $10 to $100 range. So, but we might keep an eye on that. Might be a conforming change that happens in the 82nd legislature to bring it more in line with the government code in 1916. Okay. We also made a change to Article 3802 dealing with contempt. 26.13, this deals with that domestic violence admonishment. It used to have to be given before the court. It's moved out of there and into 1406 as mandated text on the citation. And I know you heard a lot about that this morning in domestic violence. We'll move on. 27.14, this deals with guilty pleas by mail. This is an interesting change here. Plea of guilty or no contest in a misdemeanor. This became effective September 1st. Here's the story behind it. A Class C defendant wanted to plea out, but he had already missed his appearance date. And under the old law, if it was past their appearance date, they could no longer plea out by mail. He had to he was forced to appear. So he was several hundred miles away and had to drive several hundred miles to go take care of it and then drive another several hundred miles back. So, I don't think the goal is necessarily to make it easier on defendants, but it makes it easier on everybody for efficiency of the court to allow you all to take pleas of no contest or guilty by mail, even if it's after the appearance date. So now they can plea out by mail after they've missed their initial appearance date, as long as it is not within 5 days of trial. Now, I want to let you know, it doesn't have any effect on the prosecution bringing charges for failure to appear or violate promise to appear. If they miss their appearance date, they still can be charged with additional criminal charges, but they can take care of that underlying charge through the mail, even if it's past the appearance date, as long as it's not within 5 days of trial. And this could touch on several different scenarios. It sounds a little odd. Some of you might be thinking, why would I ever have somebody set for trial if they haven't made their initial appearance? They could have pled not guilty, and then they're set for trial. Then as long as it's not within 5 days, they want to plea out and take care of it. As long as you've got that five-day window, you're allowed to do that, okay? All right. 27.14 was also amended by Senate Bill 413. This is what's going to save any future statute of limitations problems. If you couple this with the one we talked about earlier in Chapter 12, now there's a mandatory filing of a complaint upon non-appearance. So there's two times when there's a mandatory filing of a complaint. Number one, this was already the law, when there's a plea of not guilty entered, triggers mandatory filing of a complaint. Now two, this is the new one, or if they fail to appear on the written notice. So if they fail to appear on that date given to them on the citation, now you have to file a formal complaint. So if that is happening, and every time somebody fails to appear, you're filing a complaint, then you should never be running into those issues from now on in the future when you get up to that 2 years and there wasn't a complaint and nobody ever showed up and you don't know what's going on. So did anybody have this just as a court policy in the past? A lot of judges already did this because it made sense. Somebody doesn't show up, I know that it means that we'll go ahead and file a formal complaint so we can move forward on it. But that's the change here. Fail to appear, formal complaint. Okay, 35.01, this is another contempt change. Jurors not present when called for trial may be fined not less than 100 or more than 500. The old law said that you couldn't fine them more than $50. 3802. Chapter 38 deals with evidence and criminal actions. This is the effect under the public information law of release of certain information. So this is how we apply the Public Information Act to act things that are happening in this criminal case. This is the new law, the release of information by the state attorney to the defense for purposes of prosecution is not considered a voluntary release of information, opening up it to everyone, okay? In the past, there's been a problem with people saying, well, prosecutor, you've given stuff over to the defense counsel. That means you've shared some information. Now it's fair game for everyone. So it's a more public information law is now limited. It's not a voluntary release of information opening it up to the public. So this is kind of reveals a long-standing struggle between the public's right to know and the safety of the public versus the right of confidentiality for prosecutors to successfully prosecute case. So it should eliminate some potential conflicts between releasing of files and the PIA. In the past, there could have been problems with a prosecutor saying, I can't give you this information because it would open it up to everyone. Now they can give it over. Okay, moving on. Anybody seen this movie here? Shawshank Redemption. Anybody tell me the name of the main character in there? Played by
Andy,
okay. And Andy Dufresne, right? Why is Andy Dufresne in prison? Murder. Murdered his wife. Did he do it? No, right? And just like the guy says in the movie, nobody here did anything. But in this case, legitimately, he didn't do it, right? And then they have this young kid come in, and he talks about how he had an inmate who told the story of killing Andy's wife, and he pinned it on Andy. Well, Andy tells the warden so that hopefully he can be released, and the warden, what does the warden do? Shoots the guy that would potentially set Andy free. So this change in law brought into mind Shawshank Redemption. It's a little bit different angle, but it deals with the testimony of a fellow inmate. Corroboration of certain testimony required under Article 38075. This prohibits the conviction of a defendant based solely on the testimony of a fellow inmate. Why do we want to get some corroboration when we're dealing with the testimony of an inmate? Do you believe everything an inmate tells you when his potential freedom is on the line? Now, just like we don't believe everything a used car salesman tells us either, their interests lay in a different arena than ours do. So now you can't prohibit a defendant based solely on that testimony. If a defendant makes a statement against his own interest while imprisoned or confined in the same correctional facility, and a guy comes forward and says, he admitted to this, I want to testify, he can't be convicted solely on that testimony. Applies to any case without judgment on September 1st, 2009. Okay, the journalist privilege in criminal proceedings. This is a new wrinkle here, just like the attorney-client privilege, clergy, husband, wife, physician, patient. This adds Articles 38.11 and 38.111. And it says you cannot compel a journalist to testify about, produce, or disclose any unpublished information, any unpublished info, document, or item obtained while acting as a journalist. Okay, and they also, you can't compel them to disclose the source. So this really is a win for journalists in keeping their information confidential. They don't have to tell you any information. They don't have to tell you where they got it from. Yes?
So if I decide I want to write a blog, I'm home free.
That's where this is going. What is a journalist? And now anybody can be a journalist in the age of the new media where everybody can have a blog. And I think some case law is going to have to come down to really solidify that, a bright line, what is a journalist and what is not. Because writing for the school paper? Maybe. Okay, communication service provider, that means, so if you have a journalist and they've got some information you want, well, I don't think it's AT&T. Now, this would be like if you have somebody, a journalist for the Austin American Statesman. You can't compel him to give the information of the source, and if you can't compel him, the communication service provider would be, in this case, the Austin American Statesman. So you can't compel the individual, and if that doesn't work, you can't go to the next level and try to get their employer, the provider, so whoever it might be, a newspaper, a TV station, so on and so forth. Yes? That's a good question. The question is, what about exculpatory evidence? There might be some rules regarding exculpatory evidence that are more specific that trump this, but this here doesn't say you can't compel them for the purposes of just prosecution. It's both sides. So I'd have to look at if there's any rules about exculpatory. We know, you know, attorneys can't withhold exculpatory evidence. There might be more specific rules that trump this. That's a good question, though. Anybody know? Think about that specific idea? What's that? Confrontation clause? Yeah, you might be able to pull that in. Okay, judgment and restitution, Article 4201 and 42.037. This made a slight change in the restitution provision of your judgment. All it did was change the default, okay? In the past, you included the victim information in the restitution provision unless you made a determination that it was unsafe to do so, and then you didn't include it, okay? Now the default is flipped. Now, in the restitution provision of your judgment, if there's confidential victim information, you don't include it at all unless you made a determination that it's safe to do so. So it changes the default to not including it unless you think it's safe rather than including it unless you think it's not safe. Subtle change. One of the benefits is hopefully it will reduce the workload of your clerk, or if you're a one-man shop, of you, of having to redact a lot of information after you get a public information request. Okay, 4303, payment of fine and commitment. We talked about commitment hearings earlier. This is the new statute effective September 1st, 2009. For a commitment hearing, a defendant can be brought before the court in person or now by means of an electronic broadcast system. So just like you can do video magistration, you can do video commitment hearings on a capious profine. So you can do that electronically. An electronic broadcast system means a two-way electronic communication of image and sound between the defendant and the court, and includes secure internet video conferencing. So it probably would be a fairly inexpensive setup. All you need is two laptops and an internet connection to be able to have, just like you're Skyping or doing Google Talk or Instant Messenger with the camera, you can do that. And it might save you a trip to the jail if you can get it set up and do it from the comfort of your own bedroom in the middle of the night, or from the comfort of your office at the courthouse. And some courts are going that way. Might be a good way if you have an abundance of technology fund monies. Might be a good idea to bring before the city council. Okay, 55.011, the right of a close relative to seek expunction on behalf of a deceased person. This came about because of Tim Cole wrongly convicted and imprisoned. I believe he was wrongly convicted of rape. He served, I think, 14 years. He died in prison. After his death, DNA evidence proved his innocence in 2008. His family understandably wanted to clear his name officially, but there was no mechanism in the law for this to happen. So this has changed now. This last legislative session, Article 55.011. If the person would have been entitled to expunction under Chapter 55, a relative may file an ex parte petition for that deceased person. Okay, so that is it for the Code of Criminal Procedure. Two other things I want to talk about briefly. Appeal of animal cruelty determinations in the Health and Safety Code. Anybody see this cartoon? You see who's on the witness stand there on trial? Michael Vick. And do you see who his jury is? We got Snoopy and Scooby-Doo and Goofy and droopy dog, but we're talking about animal cruelty determinations. This creates an appeal mechanism. So Section 11 allows a determination of animal cruelty and divestment of ownership by a municipal court. Now that determination can be appealed to county court. The municipal court has to provide a transcript of the proceeding to the county court within 5 days of notice, and then the county court has to dispose of the appeal within 10 days of receiving the transcript. So there should be a maximum 15-day timeline here if somebody wants to appeal a determination of animal cruelty and a divestment of ownership. Now, when I first read this, I got hung up a little bit on the word transcript, because so many of us are not record courts, so what does that mean? We're not going to have a typed-out transcript of everything that was said. I don't think that's required here. It just would be like if you were passing along the docket for any other appeal. Any notations, any information about the case that you would have, just send it on, is what I've been told by those in the know. Okay. The last thing that made a change here, public intoxication of children. In the past, we saw kids for a lot of alcohol offenses, but we never had jurisdiction of public intoxication. September 1st, 2009, that all changed. Now we do have jurisdiction over that. Has anybody seen a spike in public intoxication cases of kids? I don't know if it's going to have a huge effect, because police officers could always charge kids with public intoxication. They just weren't brought to us. They went a different route. So they still have those other routes available. And if they can get somebody for public intoxication, and we're talking about a kid here, what else could they get them for potentially? Possession, consumption, those types of things which might be easier to process and have less red tape to worry about. So I don't know if it's going to be... Yes? This is public intoxication of children. So we're talking about people under the age of 17. You already had public intoxication of minors, 17 through 20, and adults. We're talking, beyond... and. You have jurisdiction over them for public intoxication. You do. You do now. As of September 1st. In the past, I had to go to the juvenile court system. Legislative people said that due to heavy juvenile dockets, there was evidence that sometimes juveniles were never charged with a crime, ultimately suffered no consequences. So they shifted some more things regarding juveniles over to the municipal courts. Penal code also was changed to allow a child under 15 to be prosecuted. Here's a little comparison. An adult charged with PI may be released under 14031. And that's if an officer says detention is unnecessary and the individual is released to an adult who assumes responsibility, or they're put into a dependency program. Adults may not be issued a citation under 14.06. It's the only 14.06 is that general granting authority that allows tickets to be issued, or citations, in lieu of arrest. The one time you can't do that that's excluded is public intoxication. Okay, switching over to kids, they can't be released under 14.031, but they can be released under 45058. And they have to be released to a parent, guardian, custodian, or other responsible adult. And along with that release under 45058, they can be issued a citation upon that release. Okay, so it's really odd. And it actually says in 45058, issue them a field service citation under 14.06. It refers you back to 14.06, which specifically says you can't give a citation for public intoxication. But I think it's just giving there for general guidance. So that's how they're handled differently. Thank you for your attention. It is 5 till 5. We got through there as fast as I could. Enjoy your evening. Optional session in here. Hospitality suite upstairs. Thank you for being here and for your time.